Cowboy hats. I've been seeing a lot of cowboy hats since I came into town. And it reminds me of a routine that Stephen Wright did years ago, where he talks about how he's riding a bus, and there's a beautiful blonde Chinese girl. She looks really sad. He says, "Why are you sad?" She says, "What should I tell you? You're a complete stranger." Sometimes it helps to talk to a stranger. "Why are you sad?" She sighs and says, "I am just crazy about men, but I'm only turned on by Jewish cowboys." She says, "What's your name?" Stephen Wright says, "Bucky Goldstein." The other thing that I thought of coming into town, when I graduated from Thomas Aquinas College, I think we were up to a grand total of 2 permanent buildings. But when I started there as a freshman in 1985, we had 1 permanent building. And I was so wrapped up in going to a great books college, going to study Catholic theology with the church fathers and church doctors like St. Thomas Aquinas. You know, I think I would have gone to a college that was a shed in the desert if that's what they were offering. In fact, at that point, TAC pretty much was a shed in the desert. And I see a lot of that same passion in you. Now, granted, you've got more permanent buildings than we did at that point. But it takes a certain something to say, "I'm not going to a college with a quad or a student center or a belt, clock tower, or those things." You know, a lot of the things that, you know, maybe other people or your friends, your colleagues, people in your family are going to. But I think to enter into this college, you're drawn because of the kinds of things that it's teaching and the passion that you have for them. It's very important in Plato's Republic that he talks about how foundational thumos is to the educational life, right? Not just intellect, but passion, spiritedness. You know, if you're going to ride around on a horse in the wilds of Wyoming, you've got thumos. So I just want to commend, you know, that you've engaged in this kind of education, this kind of project for yourself. Because that shows that you have a kind of passion for these things, for the highest things. What I'd like to talk about tonight is moral confusion that we have out there in our world today, in our country today, and evangelization. How these two things are related. If you look at Evangelium Vitae by Pope John Paul II, he will talk about how necessary the new evangelization is, because we're living in a society in which there's an eclipse of the sense of God, an eclipse of the sense of man, and because there's a darkening of man's understanding of God, there is consequently a darkening of the moral sense. Now, what I'm going to be talking about is actually the converse of that. It's not just the case that somehow you can convert people and now their moral sense fixes itself. If anything, it's as if what we have to do is address people's moral sense, and that's what's going to allow them to convert. Unless we address that moral confusion, that is one of the most basic and fundamental impediments to evangelization. Let me illustrate this by what I see as a teacher, and then explicate what it is I understand the significance of this to be. Every year, with my sophomores, and also with people who are around the same age in some of the parishes that I teach in, I will give them a sheet of paper with 20 statements. And I will ask the students, tell me if those are facts or if those are opinions. And some of these statements are things like Mount Kilimanjaro is the highest mountain in Africa, the Empire State Building is 1,250 feet tall, water boils at 100 degrees centigrade. Then I have some statements like, "Good Night Moon is the best children's book ever." Michael Jordan's feet are too big. You know, things like that. Amazing, there are always a number of kids who think that Goodnight Moon is the best children's book ever is a fact. I get that periodically. But I want them to tell me, are these facts or opinions? What I do, among these 20 statements, there are three moral statements. It was unjust for the Nazis to persecute the Jews. Sexual exploitation of minor children is immoral. Religious liberty should not be a reason. There is no right to religious liberty to carry out human sacrifice. Okay? I put in those three statements. And really all I'm interested in is what the answer is to those three. And every year, without fail, a majority of 16-year-olds will tell me those are opinions. Overwhelmingly. Sometimes I can have a sophomore class of 100 students where 88 of them will tell me those things are opinions. Why do they believe those things are opinions? They believe those things are opinions because there is disagreement. Well, the Nazis thought one thing and the Jews thought another. Some people were in favor of slavery and some people were against it. Now, of course, the next thing I will ask is, well, in science you can have disagreement. There are some people who think there's global warming. Some people disagree. There are some people who think it's anthropogenic. It's caused by human beings. Other people think it's related to the sun. Even something simple like the weather. Is it going to be sunny this week or rainy? You can have disagreements. Why is it that... But we don't think that that stops there from being a fact. And, of course, then their response is, but there's a standard there. You can do an experiment. You can, test. There's nothing in morality like that. There are these moral disagreements, and there is no way to figure out who's right and who's wrong. Everybody has a kind of equal standard. Okay. Now, let me explain what I think is at stake there in the problem that creates for the faith. These are people who, by and large, have grown up in Christian homes. Most of them are Catholic. Some number of them are Lutheran or evangelical. Providence Academy is in the northwest suburbs of Minneapolis. So we're drawing from people who are middle class to upscale, generally, and have some kind of religious background. And yet for them, morality is an opinion. If you start to try to teach the faith on a bedrock of morality is an opinion, where can you get exactly? Cardinal Newman in the Grammar of Assent, if you haven't read the Grammar of Assent, it's something that you have to put down in your list of books to read. The whole point of the Grammar of Assent, the whole purpose of this wonderful book is to analyze what allows somebody to make a religious assent, someone to accept religion, and particularly the Christian faith, as an act of the will. And Newman says that the beginning of that assent is an understanding of God in conscience. We can come up with arguments, as philosophers have, about God being a first mover, a first efficient cause, right, a necessary being. But for most of human history and for most cultures, people come to see that there is some kind of a divine being from the orders of conscience in their soul. Think about if you've ever seen the great steel of the law code of Hammurabi. The very top of that steel is a picture of a guy sitting down and holding out a scroll. There's a guy standing up and taking the scroll. And I saw that picture when I was in grade school, and I always thought that Hammurabi he was a guy sitting down, he's handing the scroll, and then one of his scribes or something is taking the scroll and, you know, carrying out his orders. No. Guy who's sitting down is Marduk. It's this Babylonian god. And he's handing the laws to Hammurabi, the king. Hammurabi isn't like making up his own laws. He is receiving them from the god. The first line, the opening line of Plato's Laws. Again, something that on your list of things to read if you haven't. The Athenian stranger asks the Spartan, did a man make your laws or did a god? And the Spartan replies, a god, of course. So cultures all over the world understand that right and wrong is not something human beings invent. It is something received. It is something received. It is, to use the term of St. Paul, written on the heart. Okay? That's the most basic way that people know that there's some kind of divinity out there. They are under orders that they know they are not the cause of. This is the kind of thing that Cardinal Newman will describe as natural religion. Just like you can talk about the natural law, there's an understanding of right and wrong that people seem to have naturally. There's such a thing as natural religion. There are things that people seem to understand about their duties toward God. So that's why all around the world, even in religions that are pre-Christian, pagan, there's going to be sacrifice. There's going to be prayer. There's going to be some idea of atonement. There's going to be some idea of revelation. Right? Unless you have a religion that's just demonic, you're going to have these kind of positive elements. And note what has happened to our students. They have lost the basis for having even natural religion. Because naturally religion starts with a consciousness that there is a law that has been given to you that you are not following, and therefore you are at odds with this divine being, and now you need to be reconciled. For our students, they don't have the sense that they need to be reconciled to God. God loves them, He always loves them, and they're broken, they're wounded, but they're not sinners. Sinners implies that you're guilty of some sort of crime, right? It's as if they're sort of damaged somehow. And what happens to God at that point, He is no longer a judge who's judging your sin. Neither is He a source of mercy who now offers His Son to redeem you from sin. A term that I think puts it so nicely. At that point, you embrace a kind of therapeutic deism. You don't really believe in a personal God. You believe in the kind of great therapist in the sky. And His job is to affirm you. His job is to tell you, nobody's perfect, but you're okay. If you've ever read Jonathan Edwards, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, maybe that's a kind of Calvinist or Presbyterian extreme, right? The image is, it's like you're a spider being held above the flames of damnation. It's as if so many of our students have the kind of opposite extreme. You are just the cutest little love bunny that Jesus ever held in His two little hands. Oh, you're a little droopy, a little dirty, but otherwise you're adorable. How on earth can you have a consciousness of salvation, of being saved from sin, if you just think that you're sort of a little ragged around the edges? Okay? So that's what's at stake. Even those who have grown up with the faith, in the absence of a clear understanding of the moral law and how the moral law directly suggests that God is a judge, okay, you have lost the basics of why it is that we believe in atonement. You've lost the basics of why Christ's had to sacrifice Himself, why that sacrifice is bloody, what's behind that. Okay? So in other words, a loss of the moral law impedes your ability to receive the faith or receive it in the way that you should. Okay? Let's describe a little bit. Why does it look this way? how do we get here? One of the, there's a book by Jonathan Haidt, who's a sociologist or a psychologist of some sort. And when he was at the University of Pennsylvania, he did these experiments in terms of people's moral thinking. So he would go over to the University of Pennsylvania and he would ask the college students and the graduate students, he'd give them various scenarios for things that would be morally wrong. And almost always these students would respond, if there's some kind of physical harm, it's wrong. If there isn't any kind of physical harm, no. So he would come up with these very imaginative scenarios where we have mixed company here, so I want to address this delicately, where he would come up with kind of taboo items, people doing obscene things with animals. And these college students and graduate students would say, no one's getting hurt, so they couldn't see any problem. Then this is the thing that Haidt did. He went 2 miles to the west, to the inner city in Philadelphia, parked himself in a McDonald's, and started talking to these inner city people with these scenarios. And yes, they thought hurting people was bad, but he would ask them, hey, an obscene act with an animal, what do you think of that? Is that wrong? And these people in the inner city would just look at him like, what's the matter with you? You don't know there's something wrong with that? What's the matter with you? These people did not just act from a principle of harm. They really believed in these taboos and things that, you know, to do something like that to an animal, there was something wrong with you if you were doing it. It didn't matter whether someone was harmed or not. They bought into these taboos. They had no discomfort with them at all. And in explaining his data, Haight relies on the work of these psychologists up at the University of British Columbia, where in their research they came to the conclusion that Westerners, especially Americans, think differently about so many things, including morality, than people in the rest of the world. And they came up with a technical term for this. They said that Americans, a lot of people in the West, are weird. This was their technical term. WEIRD is an acronym. Western, Educated, Industrial, Rich Democracies. Western, Educated, Industrial, Rich Democracies. You have those factors all in the mix, you're going to have people who are morally confused. You put all those things in the mix, you have people who are morally confused in ways that less industrialized, less wealthy, less democratic societies are simply not. Okay. So we have to recognize that, yes, we can look at it in terms of history, philosophy, we can talk about Descartes and Hume and Nietzsche and so on. We have to recognize there are conditions on the ground that promote that kind of confusion. One of my more astute seniors said this. I, with a group of seniors, you know, I did this with them 2 years earlier, so I asked them, what is it with you guys? Why do you buy into this relativism? It's not as if you get it from your pastors, or it's not as if you get it from your parents. We're certainly not teaching it. One of my seniors raised their hand, no, we do get it from our parents. We do get it from our parents. And I said, what do you mean? Because our parents, let's say they're church-going Catholics, good people, they try to teach us right, and then the neighbors are doing something different. Or Aunt Joan is doing something different. And what does Mom and Dad say? Well, that's their way. The moment you do that as a parent, what you have done is said that these rules apply to us and they don't apply to Aunt Joan. These rules apply to us and they don't apply to the next door neighbor. Now, of course, the reason the parent is doing that is they don't want something embarrassing and they don't want something awkward. They don't want the kid going up to Aunt Joan, Mom says you're a sinner. But that kind of making peace, I think for many parents, unbeknownst, creates a kind of relativism in their child's outlook. It is a challenging prudential matter. How do you help your children understand that there really are moral absolutes? At the same time, negotiate your way into a world in which not everybody follows them. But if you simply say, this is that group, or these are these people, or this is this person, and somehow the rules don't apply to them, your child no longer believes that those rules are universal. To those of you at some point who plan on being parents, file this for now. One of the other things I think that's important to note in this moral confusion from living in a weird society is the fact that our language reflects that weirdness. Let me give you an example that's something that's not moral, but it shows the kind of thing I'm talking about. When I was a boy, there were no such things as wetlands. There were just swamps. Nobody talked about wetlands except for people who had training in ecology. Likewise, when I was growing up, there were no rainforests. You were, again, an ecologist if you used terms like that. We all just talked about jungles. But if you're going to try to encourage conservation, how are you going to get people to save the jungle? How are you going to get people to save the swamp? You've got to change the language to change the way that people think about things. So gay was just starting to be applied to what previously had been called sodomy when I was growing up in the 70s. That is a change in the language which changes the way people think about things. Okay? If you go to a seminar for when you're about to have a baby in the hospital, they're going to refer to you and your partner. My wife is a Filipina. She comes from a traditional society. She was insulted to be referred to as a partner. I am not a partner. I am a wife. Because in her country, there are wives and there are mistresses. You don't use generic labels that somehow lump those things together. Right? Cohabitation. I still remember a time when that was called shacking up or playing house or living in sin. You change the language to change the way that people think about things. And probably now with regard to weirdness, values. Even those of us who are Catholics fall into talking about Catholic values or true values. Values is a term that was invented by Friedrich Nietzsche. Friedrich Nietzsche is the one who starts applying that term to morals, because he's arguing that it is time for a transvaluation of all values, to recognize that values are created and they are imposed, because at the bottom of human action is will to power. Life is will to power and nothing else. And a lot of people who throw around the term values don't recognize the pedigree of that term. Alan Bloom, when he was still alive, teaching at the University of Chicago, would cover sections of Nietzsche. And of course, the students would be really disturbed by master and slave and domination of the will and so on. And Bloom would tell them, if this stuff frightens you, then stop using the word values. Right? And I would say the same to you. There are no such things as true values. You know, there are virtues, there are goods, but values are necessarily subjective, necessarily individualistic. I've sketched the problem. I'd like to start talking about how do we win the hearts and minds of people who have been formed in this? What approaches can we use to help people kind of pull away from this kind of moral confusion and give them moral clarity? How do we do that? There are four approaches that I'm going to give to you. First, I think you could call this approach, I don't know that I have names for all of them, but this one I call the shock to the system. An important thing to remember is that nobody is a moral relativist. People can try to be moral relativists. People can try real hard. But there's always something that they simply say, that's wrong. There's always a stopping point. There's always a stopping point. It's like what Aristotle says about the principle of non-contradiction. You can verbally say a thing can be and not be in the same respect at the same time. Sure, you can say it. Got a right to free speech. And likewise, you can say there are no goods, there are no absolute goods, everybody has their own values. You can say that. But there's going to come something that you say, no, that's wrong. I'll give you a couple of examples. I notice in college textbooks now, it's a shame that colleges need to almost go over the top with this, but even some of the mainstream textbooks will use the example of female genital mutilation as practiced in the Islamic world, as an example of something. Okay, you're a cultural and moral relativist. How about that? Most college women aren't going to sign on to moral relativism that far. Not going to sign on to that far. I teach high schoolers. I'm not going to use female genital mutilation as an example of something for 16-year-olds. I think that's the kind of thing that just it's sort of a conversation stopper. Arguably, nowhere really to go from there. So what it is that I've done over the past couple of years is I've used honor killings. I will talk about honor killings in Saudi Arabia. There's a famous example that's dramatized in the movie Death of a Princess. This was a Saudi Arabian princess who was shot and her lover beheaded. This was the granddaughter of one of the Saud kings who tried to run away with her lover. They were caught at the airport and they were publicly executed. A BBC journalist got a picture of this, and BBC actually ran it as a story. It was a huge sensation when this came out in the in the early late 70s, early 80s. I will talk about a movie that came out in 2005, The Stoning of Soraya M. This place takes place in rural Iran, a woman who is framed for adultery and stoned to death. It's a very powerful movie, but it's hard to watch. The stoning sequence takes 15 minutes, and I fast-forwarded it. I just couldn't watch it. I'm getting sensitive in my old age. I will give them those kind of examples, and I will say to them, maybe, you know, you think, well, those are those countries, and that's their culture, and I don't understand it, but that's there, and we're over here, and okay, how about this? And I will tell them about examples of honor killings in Arizona. There was a young woman, a 16-year-old. She was becoming more Western, wearing blue jeans, listening to Beyonce, that sort of thing. Father is getting more and more upset. She leaves the home to go live with her aunt, who's, again, more open to America. She's getting her driver's license. The two are coming out of the DMV in Tucson. The father is waiting for them in a Jeep Grand Cherokee, runs over them twice to make sure they're both dead. Okay, so that's this country. That's Arizona. Okay, you're in Minnesota. Maybe you think, well, that's Arizona. That's way down there. And then I give them an example from Coon Rapids High School. Coon Rapids High School is in the suburbs, in the northern suburbs of the Twin Cities. 2011, same kind of story. Iraqi family, a girl living with her mother and stepfather, becoming more Western. Stepdad gets crankier and crankier. She goes to live with her father in Michigan. He buys a handgun, tracks her down, double taps her in the head. Now, when you give those kind of examples to a room full of 16-year-old girls, their perspective on moral relativism changes. Okay? That's why I call this a shock to the system. One, I think, very insightful girl said, you know, when we were talking about moral relativism and it was like up here, it seems sort of true. But now that you're giving these examples, I'm not so sure. Yeah, okay, that's the intrusion of reality. But I think we have to recognize that that's what's happening for people. She's put this so nicely. That's why I repeat it to you. People are like moral relativists up here. And we need to bring them down here. Down here to earth. Many of you are familiar with Peter Kraft, who has written probably like 200 books by now. And he was, when I was at Boston College, the graduate students were on one side of the philosophy hallway. The professors were on the other side of the hallway. He was right across the hall from me. So that was one of the treats of going to graduate school there, was being able to, you know, visit regularly, talk regularly with Peter Kraft. He told me about a class that he had where students were arguing about there being any kind of good or any kind of moral law. Everybody has their own virtues. Everybody has their own goods. Everybody has their own opinion. And he argues with them for about 10 minutes. And finally he just says, you know, I'm tired of you guys arguing with me. I'm the professor. I'm the expert here. You don't know what you're talking. You're just students. I'm failing you. All of you kids who are arguing with me, you're failing. And of course, what do you think they said? They're outraged. That isn't right. That isn't fair. You can just, if you know Peter Kraft, I mean, he gets this completely impish look in his face and says, oh, is there a fairness? Is there some standard that I know and you know and we're all supposed to follow? Right? Again, relativism seems to end at your grade. The second approach. So many people have the view that no matter what you grow up with, that's it for you. So people are simply passive to their upbringing, passive to their culture. So how can there be any absolute right and wrong? Some people raise Hindus, some people raise Buddhists, some people are raised with the feathered serpent god of the Aztecs, some people are raised with no god at all, right? There are all these different ways that people are raised, and they are simply the products of their upbringing. There are a lot of ways to go after that. One thing that I point out to them is, you know, think about people like Socrates. Socrates is growing up in a society that accepts these Greek gods, accepts them as behaving in certain ways. And what does he do? In dialogues like the Euthyphro, whoa, we believe that bravery and honesty and fidelity, that these are goods. But look at our gods. Zeus chases anything in a skirt. If these are the real gods, shouldn't they be better than us? These gods are all worse than us. Okay? What allows them to do that? Now, you can say, well, there were pre-Socratics, there were other philosophers at the time who influenced him. Okay, that just puts it back a step. How did those guys question the religious beliefs they had, or take one part of their culture and bring it to the other part and say, these don't fit? What do we say about these people who end up being reformers or witnesses or prophets? People who speak against the beliefs of their own culture. There's a wonderful book. If you've ever been exposed to the cultural relativism that you get out of anthropology, that somehow there are all these different cultures, and I just felt perpetually when I was in public school as a boy that we'd be watching these films on, oh, I don't know, some tribe that they had discovered in New Guinea, and people in this tribe steal and kill each other all the time, but it is accepted among the Gangu people, right? In other words, there are just all these wild, bizarre kinds of practices, and you couldn't think them up yourself if you tried. If you've been sort of scarred by that, like I have, a book that will ease your pain is Robert Edgerton's Sick Societies. Robert Edgerton is now a retired professor of anthropology at UCLA. Okay, so he's not some marginal guy. This is a mainstream anthropologist. But as you can tell from this title, Sick Societies, I didn't know anthropologists were allowed to write books with titles like that. You know, isn't everybody kind of wonderful in their own way? Now, there are a lot of wonderful things about the book. I don't have time to talk about them. Let me focus on one chapter there. There's a chapter that he has called Rebellion and Dissent. And what he talks about are these various tribes and peoples that had a certain way of doing things, that they had people within the tribes who rebelled. He talks about, hey, let's take New Guinea. That's a popular one. Cannibals who live in the highlands of New Guinea. That is their culture. You fight the other tribe, beat the tar out of them, take the dead, eat them. Okay? Isn't that something that they're just going to accept? After westernization, after the Australians had moved into New Guinea, of course on the heels of westernization, anthropologists all move in and they do interviews. And F.J. Porter Poole, a British anthropologist, in interviewing these formerly cannibalistic tribes, he discovers a number of people in these tribes who say things like, you know, I just could never do it. It was just expected that we ate human flesh. I couldn't do it. It just made me nauseated. He ran into people who would eat animal flesh and pretend that it was human flesh. He would run into people who they would kind of force themselves to eat it, but then they'd throw up later because they were just too disgusted. Here's a culture where they've all been taught to be cannibals. Aren't they just going to receive that passively? The answer, no. Something in them rebels at the idea of eating human flesh. The Yanomami, the fierce people. This was a tribe in Brazil that was just perpetually at war with its neighbors. And after the Brazilians moved up and pacified the area, they interviewed people in the Yanomami. Hey, do you miss the old days? And these Yanomami warriors, no way! It was just awful. You couldn't go to the bathroom in the morning without worrying that someone was going to put a spear through you. Now, of course, my young people ask me, well, if they didn't like it, why did they keep doing it? This betrays a certain lack of self-knowledge. They think that somehow if people don't like things, they feel very free to speak them out. Let's think through this scenario. Here you are in a warrior society, right? A society that lives by blood and spear. And you're going to stand up and say, oh, guys, isn't this kind of stupid? Why don't we live a life of peace and negotiation? Do you think that the other members of the tribe are going to applaud? I mean, if they applaud you, it's going to be the, you know, the slow applause. Okay? They're not going to welcome that. The problem is that you can have a practice that people within that culture are aware is problematic in some way. But at the same time, the costs are too great of changing or opposing the practice. So in other words, simply because people carry out things do not mean that they're easy in their own mind or easy in their own heart with doing them. A final example. My father in his professional life, was an anthropologist. When you tell people that you grew up in Alaska, the first thing people ask is, were you in the military? No, my father was an anthropologist. You know, there's military and anthropologists. And there's some other people doing things up there, too. My father studied Eskimos and Indians and so on. And one of the groups of people that he studied were Australian Aborigines. In fact, we lived in Australia for 5 months while he was doing this. And he ran into a very old Australian elder named Boramura. And Boramura told him the following story. In his village in Arnhem Land, this is in the northeast Australia, there are kept in the woods sacred icons, sacred images, and only the initiated men are allowed to see them. If women or children accidentally see them, they are punished by death. They are not allowed to look at them. I, when I was a little boy, age 5, participated in one of the ceremonies where they brought out these sacred images. And during parts of the ceremony, the women and children have to turn around. There were men with spears walking around, making sure that all the women and children were turned around. My father told me they might hesitate because you're American, but don't bet on it. So, in Buramura's village, very, very far to the north from this place where I was, he would have been about 16. He's eating with a friend, and all of a sudden the friend has a spear come through his chest. He had accidentally seen the images, and so he was killed. Buramura said, "This has to end." So he and a group of his friends, in the middle of the night, went and took all of the images from out in the forest. They brought them to the middle of the village, and they cemented them into the ground. So when the sun rose, people come out of their huts, and there are the images in the middle of the village. No one dared to come out of their huts. They had no idea what to do. And overnight, literally overnight, they had to completely change their customs with regard to the sacred images. What allowed someone like Boramura to do that? He's been raised in a society to accept this. And yet, he rebelled. He rebelled. And that's what you find in societies, whether it's Socrates or all sorts of unknown people who stand up against these immoral practices. They have some form of moral information that isn't just their culture. Where are they getting that from? There has to be something written on their conscience that informs that. I think helping people see that kind of thing, again, that's a second approach. Helping them see that we are not simply passive to our upbringing, we're not simply passive to their culture. By the way, if people are so passive to their upbringing, how come I can't get my children to turn off the lights upstairs? A third approach. If you recall, a lot of people become relativists because all they see is disagreement. They think that it's just all moral disagreement. And one of the things that I found very helpful over the years is to just give them the 8 pages of what is called the Illustrations of the Tao. This is an appendix to C.S. Lewis's Abolition of Man. Again, if you've never read The Abolition of Man, something to write down on your list of books to read. I realize some of you at this point are feeling, do you think I have like all the spare time in the world to just read all these? Well, but you might read one or two of these books. You know, if I give you a bunch of them, maybe you'll read one. In any event, The Abolition of Man, what he does in this appendix is categorizes groups all sorts of moral precepts from around the world, from the Babylonians, from Hindus, Chinese, and across 5,000 years of recorded history. And what it is he shows that regard to things like honor your parents, you know, love your country, be faithful to your wife, you can see those precepts all over the place. Every culture has them. Now, it's not as if there isn't moral disagreement. Obviously, there are cultures that believe you have one wife, and there are cultures that believe you have 4 or 5, right? There are those kind of disagreements. But every culture is going to have some form of institutionalized marriage. You can't just have any woman you want. So once you see that, that helps people to see that it isn't just all disagreement, because that's what's more obvious to them. The disagreements among peoples are what is more obvious to them. But when you realize, look, how would a culture make it to the end of the week or the end of the day if it tried to carry out some kind of moral code radically different from what you have in the Illustrations of the Tao? dishonor your parents, kill, steal, right? How does that culture, how do you have a culture survive which builds statues of honor to cowards? He ran away. You can carry out a kind of reductio ad absurdum there. Now, sometimes the very clever will say, well, but isn't that just all for the good of society? That isn't like good for the individual. That's good of society. Remember the weird thing, okay? They're just thinking about individuals. They're just focused on that. Well, I think the thing to say to that is, you know, if we're naturally social, then in fact what's good for society does redound to what's good for us. Human beings are naturally social. You put somebody in solitary confinement for an excessive amount of time, they go bananas. Okay? The most introverted person you like, who after a day of being around people really needs to just decompress and get away and so on, solitary confinement is not a treat for introverts. Okay? If you're naturally social, you're meant to live with other people, you're meant to be in friendship, love, and other forms of relationship with other people, then in fact, the laws that make society possible belong to you too. Finally, I think one helpful approach is the problem of unjust laws. My sophomores every year read Martin Luther King Jr.'s letter from a Birmingham jail. And what I do is I show them, I give them 10 minutes where I show them segregation in the South. I show them black-white drinking fountains. I show them demonstrations where demonstrators are literally being knocked off their feet by fire hoses or bitten by police dogs. I show them the signs that say things like "No nigger or ape allowed in the store." And for many of my students, I would say for most of them, this is a complete revelation. This is a complete revelation. For some of them, I think they would sooner say the F word than they would say the word nigger. I mean, they really do have an internalized sense of that kind of being a bad word. And perhaps this also goes back to the inconsistency of moral relativism, right? Nobody can do that consistently. But the very fact that you now enforce this in law, that you separate people by race, that you, when you bomb churches, you don't really bother investigating it, that you feel free to lynch people that you consider uppity, okay? It's going to be hard to say that those kinds of laws are not unjust, that there isn't some kind of reform that's necessary. I will talk about the Nuremberg trial. Right, the Nazi leadership that was tried after World War II. An even more striking example, Adolf Eichmann. Adolf Eichmann had hid out in Argentina for almost three decades, and the Mossad, right, the Israeli Secret Service, figured out where he was. They picked him up right off the streets of Buenos Aires, put him in a car, took him to the airport, and tried him in Jerusalem. And Hannah Arendt, the longtime philosopher at the New School for Social Research, she talked about how it is that the only way that you could try someone like Eichmann is if you believe that people know thou shalt not kill. It's the only way you can try people like Eichmann. If there really is a knowledge that they should have about taking innocent life that they are denying. Hannah Arendt, in fact, famously argued that Eichmann wasn't a monster or a demon, even though he was in charge of the final solution. If anything, he exemplified what Hannah Arendt called the banality of evil. He was a government official carrying out his job. My job is to route Jews to concentration camps and loneliness. That's my job. That's my project. And I was supposed to follow orders and do my task well. If we're going to look at those kinds of things and say that that is an unjust law, if we're going to try people for things like crimes against humanity and war crimes, there's got to be some kind of law against the human law, against the man-made law. Dr. King points out, everything that Hitler did in Germany was legal. Right? Everything the Hungarian communists did in Hungary was legal. But the reason we admire the freedom fighters in Hungary or the people who helped the Jews was because we thought those laws were wrong. There's no way that those laws could be challenged unless there was some higher law above them. When I was at Boston College in the philosophy department, political science department, there were a lot of people there who were followers of Leo Strauss. And I used to have these great arguments with them back and forth. There's a line of Strauss's that I particularly liked over the years, and it seems to me to apply here. Strauss is talking about politics, but it seems to me it also applies to morals. Namely that if there's to be a recovery of morality and moral thought, we must recover and think through the original experiences from which our moral ideas are derived. There must be a recovery of the original experiences from which our moral experiences are derived. And that's what all of these approaches are attempting to do. By appealing to the experience of other cultures, by looking for things that people object to, even when they're trying to be moral relativists, we're really trying to hit people with reality. Our moral language about justice and bravery and generosity and those things is derived from human nature. But in a weird society, in a Western, educated, industrialized, rich, democratic society, we can lose our moorings from reality and think that we're simply making it all up. Right? We're up here. And what we need to do is bring people back down to earth, bring people back to reality. Let me conclude with a personal example. Let me conclude with a personal testimony. My father grew up Catholic. He was a head altar boy at St. Augustine's Parish in North St. Louis. And he went off to a Catholic college in 1953 and fell away from the faith. And he was out of the faith for 3 decades. So I grew up as an atheist. I grew up in what I would describe as a devout atheist home. I was not baptized. We did not go to church on Easter or Christmas or any of that. For me, Easter was colored eggs and chocolate bunnies. Christmas was entirely presents in a tree. The Who's, holding hands and singing Dabu Dorks. Okay? That was what I knew about those holidays. I did not know that Easter had anything to do with the resurrection of Christ until I converted. I simply did not know that. There wasn't enough cultural information in the air for me to know that. For the longest time, I was perfectly self-satisfied as an atheist. And certainly coming into high school, I felt that atheism was more rational. This was something that you could argue, you could defend. And Christians only appeared to be Christians out of emotion, out of their upbringing. I mean, how do you know there's a God? You know there's a God every time you see a rainbow, every time a baby's born. One of the things that didn't help was growing up in the era that I did. I grew up, my childhood was in the 70s. So my exposure to Christianity was Jesus Christ Superstar and Godspell. Jesus was a hippie. Make love, not war. Okay? That was my picture of Jesus. That's what I got from the popular culture around me. So once I got into high school, there were things I was starting to pick up and read, and I was starting to get interested in philosophy. And it's almost embarrassing to admit this, but I got interested in philosophy because there was a rock group that I was listening to, and this rock group was into Ayn Rand. If any of you are familiar with Ayn Rand, Ayn Rand is a radical libertarian, Atlas Shrugged, the Fountainhead, and wow, rock and roll that makes you think. So I got into Ayn Rand. People get into philosophy from sometimes some very odd routes. But I was already kind of picking things up and reading. And then I picked up, I heard that there were real proofs for the existence of God. And they were in Thomas Aquinas. And we had these Britannia great books, in my father's library. So I pulled down the volume with St. Thomas and I opened it up and there are these arguments, and it isn't like, every time you see a rainbow and a baby's born, and first mover, first efficient cause. Now, I was 16 years old, I didn't have some background in logic that I could analyze them, but I could recognize that these were arguments. They weren't just emotion, they weren't just wishful thinking, there was a premise, there were steps, there was a conclusion. And so that made me think, well, maybe there's at least something to believing there's a God. About the same time, my father, like a lot of leftists, my father, I say that he went to a Catholic college and fell away from the faith. He finished his schooling at the University of California, Berkeley, in the early 60s, with everything that that implies. My father was a radical leftist. He was the founder and first state president of the American Civil Liberties Union in the state of Alaska. Okay? That's how radically left he was. But like a lot of 60s radicals, by the beginning of the 1980s, he was starting to have second thoughts. There were a lot of people who had been leftists in the 60s, and by the 80s were starting to... It was like the hangover was wearing off. My father will tell me, you know, you look back at the 60s, I don't know how to explain it. None of us do. anyway, he was part of a discussion group, and it was a conservative discussion group, and they called themselves the Wednesday Night Club, and they met on Thursdays to fool the liberals. Okay? And no matter what the time, they would have a dinner, they'd go to a restaurant and have a dinner and drink and argue. And no matter what the topic was, this group would divide into two sides. There were the social conservatives, who were mostly Catholics and evangelicals, and there were the fiscal conservatives, who were mostly libertarians and your kind of country club Republicans. Okay? And no matter what the issue was, these two groups of guys would fall on either side. And the issues always really turned on, can you have a morality without there being a God? And the libertarians wanted to say you could, and the evangelicals and the Catholics said no. Well, they started sending books for my father to read. And my father takes these books home. And my father very imprudently left these books lying around. So I think this was probably the first time I would have read Mere Christianity. And I don't know that it made much of an impression, but I at least got the idea that Christians weren't the same kind of yahoos I thought they were. This wasn't just holy roller fundamentalism. But the book that I remember that had a really devastating effect were a couple of books by Francis Schaeffer. Francis Schaeffer, if you're a Catholic, is not a name that's probably known to you. Francis Schaeffer is known a lot more in Reform circles, Presbyterian circles, and evangelicals. Francis Schaeffer, the one thing I could point to, he was the one who got evangelicals up in arms about abortion. In the early 70s, evangelicals were not politically active. They weren't doing anything. And he was the one who kind of scolded them into abortion has become legal because you have done nothing. And that woke them up. Okay. But he wrote a lot of apologetical works. The one that sticks with me, How Then Shall We Live? Or How Shall We Then Live? There are others, the God who is there, he is there and he is not silent. These are all apologetic works. But long and short of it is this. Francis Schaeffer argued that the further that Western man has gotten from Christianity, the loonier he has become. So when you look at music under Bach and Beethoven and Gregorian chant and so on, that's beautiful music. What happens in the modern era? John Cage. 4 minutes and 33 seconds of silence. Right? There's the pianist. Sitting in front of the piano. 4 minutes and 33 seconds. Wow, the triumph of rationality. Okay, art. You look at things like Rembrandt or iconography or Titian or Raphael or... There are some of the kind of Renaissance excesses that I think Schaeffer's not crazy about. But he says, everybody recognizes this is beautiful art. What happens in the modern era? You're going to have things like blue panel. This is in the Museum of Modern Art in New York City, where it's literally a square, about 20 foot by 20 foot, that's just blue. Deep. Finally, philosophy. He says he's Presbyterian, he's of the Reformed tradition, so he has his gripes about St. Thomas. But he says, at least this is rational, right? There are arguments. You get into Descartes and Kant and Nietzsche, these people are all irrational, they're all skeptics. They all end up throwing out reason in some way. Well, I got to the end of that, and that for me was a hit to the hull. That was devastating, because I had always thought that atheism was more rational. Atheism made sense. Atheism was defensible, was logical. And here's someone pointing out to me that things that I can recognize as ugly or despairing or crazy, these are all things that have arisen in an era of unbelief. And I remember at one point thinking to myself, because he puts a kind of dilemma that either Christianity is right or Nietzsche's right. Either there is an order of the universe, God has set up the universe, God is provident and loving and he's come to save the human race, or there is no providence, there's just human beings and it's all will to power. Here I am, 17 years old. Will to power. It's kind of, I mean, it sounds kind of cool. Sounds like an album title. What am I going to choose? What am I going to believe? And just at a certain breaking point, I realized, you know, I've never thought that morality was relative. I never thought that it was all invented. I never thought that somehow I was the master of creating values. I've never believed that. I've always acted as if there's some kind of moral law that I should follow. There's some way that I should follow. So if I'm not going to embrace Nietzsche, I guess I've got to become Catholic. And later on that week, I went to church for the first time in my life. My father went to confession for the first time in 30 years, 2 weeks later. And then my sister converted, then my brother converted, and then last, my mother. Now, just as I have to say, to give credit where credit is due, yes, there were books, there were arguments and so on, but really it was my grandmother. My father's mother. People make a big deal about St. Monica, right? Persevering and praying for years. He was out from 17 to 31. That's 14 years. My dad was out for twice that. So there. When I was 16 years old, we got this prayer card from the Blue Army of Fatima. If you've ever seen prayer cards from the Blue Army of Fatima, they're what I call sort of arch-traditional Catholic artwork. It's like Mary is like all in gold and silver, and she's shooting rays of blue and red light. This card said, "You have been enrolled in a year of masses from the Blue Army of Fatima." And I remember my father making fun of this. Here is my Polish mother with her old world superstitions enrolling us in a year of masses. Rolling out of the eyes. My grandmother, 6 months later, was dead. Within a year of her death, the entire family was Catholic. Within a year of her death. But I share this with you because I have found for myself that, yes, God's graces are working there, but the way that God's grace has worked in me is that when this dilemma came, that I was able to choose Christ and choose the church that he founded. But that dilemma had to happen. I had to see that there was an alternative. The alternatives were morality or chaos. And I offer that to you because I think for so many of our people, when they're away from the faith, maybe you want to bring them apologetics right away. Maybe you want to have them read the gospel right away. Maybe you just think if you bring them to church, you know, that kind of experience will help. But it could be that this kind of moral clarity is what they need. They're in a kind of moral make-believe world that you have to break through that to help them see that they need a Savior. Unless you are conscious of sin, you don't understand that you need a Savior. T.S. Lewis put it so nicely, and I'll end with this. When the apostles preached, they preached to people who understood sin. They understood that they were sinners. And they knew that they needed salvation. And so that's why to say that there is a God who took on human nature and died for you, that's good news. That's why the gospel is good news. If you don't believe you're a sinner, how can the good news be good news? In fact, to tell people are sinners is decidedly bad news. But it's like people have to have that bad news first. There's no good news. There's no good news of the gospel unless there's first the bad news of that self-knowledge of where we stand with regard to our Lord and with regard to the law that He's written on our hearts. Again, thank you so much for the for allowing me to come and address you. These are things that are very dear to my heart, because every year this is what I spend my time doing, talking to sophomore 16-year-olds about morality and about faith. And it is such a privilege to be able to come and talk with you about these things. Thank you.